Hi, I'm Orman Olney, host of To The Point. Welcome, as always, to our veteran podcast listeners and to our converts from radio. Today, we're talking about the deep state. In this divided country, it's no surprise that means different things to different people. To Rush Limbaugh, it's an entrenched bureaucracy with allies in politics and the media undermining President Trump with fake news about the damage being done by his administration.
The Obama administration and its holdovers in the deep state trying to sabotage the duly elected president of the United States. That is the story. That is what is happening. And it's happening right in front of our eyes. It's not even a secret. We see the results of it every day in the New York Times, which I believe is complicit with Obama and the Democrats in this attempted sabotage.
Once again, that was Rush Limbaugh, but others say the deep state is nothing new. It has a history, going all the way back to President Dwight Eisenhower and that famous warning in his farewell address in 1961.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Our first guest wrote a book called The Deep State before Donald Trump was even elected. His deep state had its origins decades ago. He's Mike Lofgren. He spent 28 years on Capitol Hill. He was a staffer for Republican members of the House and the Senate budget committees. The full title of his book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. Great to talk with you.
It's good to be here, Warren.
Did you see yourself when you were working in Congress or after you left as a person who was, in fact, part of the deep state?
Towards the end, certainly after the experience with the Iraq War, if I wasn't of the deep state by a sort of inclination or mentality, I was at least a part of the outer circle of the deep state as a functionary. Now, our other guest is going to have a slightly different take on this, but mine is certainly not that of Rush Limbaugh or the right-wingers who claim this is some vast conspiracy against Trump. It's not a conspiracy. It's simply the kind of congealing of illiberal tendencies in our liberal democracy. Some of the things that the deep state does are perfectly anodyne and perfectly good. We want the FAA to inspect aircraft, regardless of who is president. We want the Centers for Disease Control to keep infectious diseases out of the country, and good bureaucrats do that, regardless of who's in power. On the other hand, certain senior people, not politicians, but appointees or senior bureaucrats in some of the cabinet departments and agencies, mainly in national security matters and to some degree in financial matters, do become a kind of priesthood or clerisy. And I noticed it became all too easy to get into wars, for instance, whereas Congress clearly has the power to declare war under the Constitution, somehow all the signals are set and the train rolls down the track and there's not much Congress is going to do about it.
Well, wait a minute. Now, we heard President Eisenhower talking about the military-industrial complex. He allegedly thought there was, in fact, a congressional element to it. It was the military-industrial congressional element. Do you think that's true?
It's true insofar as Congress isn't doing its job because it gets all kinds of contributions from defense contractors and jobs in the district from those contractors and at military bases. That's certainly true. The military-industrial complex is a core component of the deep state. It's not the only thing. We see this in the revolving door between the Treasury Department, some of the other financial agencies, and Wall Street, whether it's Hank Paulson or Mnuchin or virtually all recent Treasury secretaries. They all have a perspective that's formed on Wall Street, and they get into the government, and they tend to govern on behalf of Wall Street.
What about Silicon Valley?
Silicon Valley is sort of the newest component. Now, the military-industrial complex and certainly its intelligence agencies couldn't do their job without Silicon Valley. It's the greatest generator of wealth that we have, even eclipsing Wall Street. Apple's market value is getting close to $1 trillion. Google and some of the others aren't far behind. This is an enormous geyser of wealth, and I would argue that their ability to vacuum up data for commercial purposes, there are far fewer safeguards for the average citizen than exist with the NSA. They're supposed to get a warrant. Things that they vacuum up incidentally, they're not supposed to use, or they're supposed to obscure the identities. Whereas you have no control, you have no recourse when it's Silicon Valley essentially spying on you for commercial purposes.
So this is a priesthood then that extends from the military-industrial complex, perhaps to the Congress as well, certainly to the cabinet officers, to in the financial branches of government and the intelligence branches of government, also to Silicon Valley. What are their goals?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a conspiracy. I don't believe in those things. Conspiracies are like intelligent design. It's simply a shifting coalition of various interests. We know the names of virtually all the people. They operate in broad daylight. It's not a conspiracy. It's simply an erosion of democracy. And who's at fault? Ultimately, the American people are at fault in the sense that they do not exercise their franchise, in that voting participation rates are some of the lowest here of any of the developed democracies. People would rather watch reality TV than true reality TV of maybe a documentary on following the money and what happened to it in the 2008 crash.
Let me just read something from the back of your book. Hooked on war, genuflecting to big donors, enthralled to discredited economic theories, and utterly bereft of moral compass. What are the consequences of a deep state that you describe that way? What does that mean for people?
It means sort of the status quo of what we've had and has gradually grown worse over the last 20 or 30 years. It's not maybe the worst of all worlds, but it's definitely an erosion of democracy under control of the citizens. There are worse things than the deep state. An out-and-out plutocracy based on force, fraud, and violence would be worse, and I'm afraid we're getting close to that now.
So we know the people. Is Donald Trump then part of the deep state?
Well, he certainly is in terms of coming out of the New York media market. All those elites he decries essentially made him what he is. He wouldn't exist without the New York Post or the daily news. You know, ever since the 1980s, the tabloids have been writing gushing articles about his every doing.
Would Hillary Clinton have been part of the deep state had she been elected?
Well, she's, you know, been on the American stage for decades. She has a somewhat unfortunate inclination towards believing in force rather than diplomacy. She's certainly not at odds with the goals of the military-industrial complex insofar as it's a component of the deep state.
What about Wall Street?
If you look at all that she was paid for, it was millions of dollars for speeches to Wall Street firms. She certainly was not Eugene Debs or some populist who was on a crusade against Wall Street.
Well, does the deep state go all the way back to the Clinton administration?
Oh, it certainly does. Much of the things that we see are kind of outgrowths of that, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, allowing these big firms to get even bigger without any restraint on them. We also saw this unfortunate tendency to get into small wars, whether it's Somalia, the Balkans, that's kind of established the template for what happened after 9/11. We're now in a situation of perpetual war for perpetual peace.
Again, we're talking with Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years in Congress and has written a book called The Deep State. We're also joined by a man who has written an article in Foreign Affairs magazine under the title Trump and the Deep State. The subheadline is The Government Strikes Back. That writer is John Michaels. He's a professor of law at UCLA. He's author of a book called Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Professor, good to have you on our show.
Thank you.
So do you mean the same thing by deep state that that we hear from Mike Lofgren? Because in your article, you say the article idea of a deep state has little relevance to the United States.
Well, so I think there's a terminology issue. And let's start with the kind of understanding of what the deep state has meant in colloquial conversations for the past 20 or 30 years. It's often associated with places like Turkey and Pakistan and Egypt, where a democratic movement takes root and is pushed down or suppressed by kind of elite cabals within the military or in some countries within the clerical community or the to use the term that was discussed before, the plutocrats kind of close ranks on these kind of populist movements. So first and foremost, I'm concerned with the kind of ready importation of the term deep state into the United States because it connotes a level of danger and kind of insidiousness that I don't think exists here. The second concern I think I have with the concept of the deep state in America, and let's play off the notion of this kind of this notion of a priesthood that I think Mike brought up, and I think it's a very helpful and useful way to think about this. And I guess where I would part company on some of these points is to say if it's a priesthood, it's more of an interfaith conclave. This is not a kind of monolithic set of elites that move in lockstep, that kind of coordinate their activities in a way that's defiant or in any way, let's say, oppositional to democracy per se. I think what we have here is different segments of civil society and different segments of the American bureaucracy that traffic in expertise, that traffic in experience, that do have connections, just as populist elected officials have connections. And they're bringing to the table a number of interests, some of which are some of which may be at odds at particular moments with the kind of, you know, the presidential leadership or the leadership in Congress. But to be clear, that's not necessarily inconsistent with our constitutional scheme. The term that Mike used, I think, was, you know, it's illiberal and undemocratic. Well, we have a republic, and baked into our Constitution are all sorts of undemocratic elements that are supposed to provide kind of helpful checks and balances. And maybe we have the balance a little bit wrong. But we've always had counter-majoritarian elements within our government, even before we even thought about the notion of a thick state or a deep state. To think about particularly the bureaucracy, as a counterweight to the political leadership, I celebrate that. I think that's virtuous because we have values other than simply kind of riding the populist tide that we want to make sure we remain true to.
Well, Mike Loughran said at the outset he's all in favor of the FAA keeping the planes in the air and the CDC making sure that we don't have outbreaks of disease. But with regard to democracy, he also pointed out that we have very, very low participation in our elections and virtually perpetual war, given the institutions that he says are running the show, the military-industrial complex, and Wall Street, which, of course, profits from military activity, and the intelligence agencies. What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I think the point where we agree on that there's we're running the risk of plutocracy. We're running the risk of having such inequality in our country that a lot of participants are either expressly or systematically disenfranchised because of failure to enact meaningful campaign finance reform, because of the kind of limited attention, because of educational disparities. I completely agree on all those points. But I do worry about this notion that expertise is what's propelling us into kind of a warmongering posture. To suggest, and I think it's interesting to think about your line of questioning towards the end of, is Hillary Clinton in the deep state? Is Donald Trump in the deep state? Well, they're assuming elections are fair. The president of the president of the United States is the nationally elected leader. If he or she is part of the deep state, then how is I fail to see how the notion of a deep state is oppositional to political forces kind of holds any kind of definitional.
Let me go back to Mike Loughran. My understanding of your what you were saying was not so much that they were part of the deep state in the sense that they were signed up and went to the meetings, but rather that they couldn't do anything to stop the deep state, and that in fact whatever party they happen to serve. And now we're talking about Trump and Clinton, but we could talk about the other Clinton, and we could talk about George W. Bush, and we could talk about Barack Obama as well. That in fact the same forces are really running the show. Either way, is that what you're saying?
Yes. Basically, Huey Long once said that you have Democratic waiters and Republican waiters, but it's all served up in the same plutocratic kitchen. And that's sort of what I'm saying. And I am certainly in this atmosphere of virulent anti-intellectualism that we see coming out of the White House. I am not opposed to expertise per se in terms of running the government, running the state. In fact, I would argue that many of these people in this so-called national security priesthood are not all that competent. The CIA missed the collapse of the Soviet Union. Bob Gates was deputy secretary at the time, or deputy CIA director at the time. Bill Casey, who was the director, was dying at the time and had very little consciousness of what was going on at the end. Essentially, those intelligence estimates were made by Bob Gates, who totally missed the collapse of the Soviet Empire, one of the great events of the 20th century.
And then went on to be the Secretary of Defense.
A wise man, who served as director later and then Secretary of Defense.
So what about expertise, John Michaels? Is that really what you're talking about?
Well, but so I guess I'm a little bit confused still, because those are political appointees. Now, it's true that the folks at the, you know, at the desk jobs missed it as well. But to lay the blame solely on the at the feet of the kind of career workforce is a little bit kind of missing the point. That it's saying that government is fallible. Yes, government is. Lends itself to undue influence by those with money or those with seniority. Yes, I'm just not sure it's helpful to suggest that there's these kind of powerful elements within the government that are subverting the democratic will, as much as they are either A, working in a kind of push-pull, sometimes cooperative, sometimes oppositional relationship to the political leadership, which again I think is healthy and consistent with our constitutional norms, or to the extent they're wielding what we would think is outsized power that often could be a failure of political leadership, not necessarily just that the political leaders are captured by these elements, but that they're not necessarily opposed to these views. Now,
I'm going to interrupt you again. Mike Lofgren, back to you. One of the things that you point out is when you talk about being in a state of perpetual war, is that whereas we're not fixing the infrastructure, despite the promises of the current president and presidents past, we're not doing other things. We're not taking very good care of ourselves in terms of health. And yet we always have the money to conduct a surge or make an attack on another country or something of that kind. Is that what you mean when you say that the will of the people is to a certain extent being thwarted by the deep state?
Well, if you look at things like single-payer health care, if you look at rebuilding infrastructure, those things are quite popular. But somehow they never translate into policy. Trump got elected partially on a platform of rebuilding the infrastructure. Instead, his budget cuts the transportation department and all these great infrastructure plans. With respect to what your other host guest said about privatization being a very two-edged sword, he basically sells off infrastructure to private companies. That's how it's going to be done. And I don't think that's the proper way to do it. That's not the way President Eisenhower did the Highway Act in 1957.
Okay, so here's Donald Trump during the campaign in June of last year. And it's very interesting that he said this particular thing. And John Michaels, I particularly want you to respond to this.
The insiders wrote the rules of the game to keep themselves in power and in the money.
That, John Michaels, sounds pretty much like what Mike Lofgren's saying.
Yeah, again, I don't have a disagreement on the fact that the system is set up to reward those who curry favor with the affluent. I just don't see how that is the reason why we're going to war as opposed to not having health care. I think there is a considerable amount of cognitive dissonance in the American voting public. Mm-hmm. I think there is there's a mantra of or a history of kind of we are going to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. That's evident in the way that people, the voting or the opinion polling breaks down on who supports an estate tax. There are plenty of people who are nowhere close to making $5 million who think that one day they will make $5 million and they vote, or at least they express their preferences to pollsters accordingly. There are, and if I could just circle back more generally, there are these types of, if you want to kind of use a pejorative kind, term, entrenched interest in most of the developed world. And most of the developed world is not nearly as kind of war, adventurous on the military front as we are. So it can't just be entrenched interest or defense contractors. There's something else also that has to play into this kind of divergent commitment to where guns wins out over butter.
Do you think that people understand the difference in cost, though, and the fact that they are making an exchange by beefing up the military? We now have more military power than whatever it is, the next 8 or 10 states combined. And as you indicated, we don't have health care or good outcomes in health care by comparison to other nations. And we're not fixing up the infrastructure, which could be disastrous for the economy. Do you, John Michaels, really think people understand that and are making a choice?
I don't. I'm not exactly sure that they are. Again, I think that in any type of kind of head-to-head choice, guns wins out over butter. And that's not true in other countries that also have entrenched elites. So I'm not quite sure if that is the issue. But I think you're right. And let me tell you something that the military does do, and it does it thanks to the good graces of Congress. In my book, I talk about the relative kind of popular distaste for the domestic bureaucracies, the civil servants and the EPA, Department of Interior, and the vaunted status of the military. And one of the reasons I think that's true is not just that there's this kind of intrinsic patriotism that kind of filters out that way. The military is appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars to engage in direct advertising. So they're, funding events at NFL games. They're partnering with superheroes, Marvel Comics. They're doing kind of fancy commercials that appear before kind of blockbuster movies. And they're capturing the Americans' attention. When the EPA even sends out tweets kind of announcing that there's a new rule that they're thinking about to clean up the waters of the United States, they get slapped down by Congress saying don't engage in propaganda. So whether that's, again, there's some kind of invisible hand that's pressuring Congress to thwart kind of domestic shows of kind of regulatory strength and prop up the military. I'm not exactly sure, but it's a big issue that's not simply about I think vested interests as much as all sorts of political choices that we're making explicitly and implicitly.
So, Mike Lofgren, is that the big state, or do the voters get what they deserve?
Now, it's interesting that John Michaels, perhaps I'm overinterpreting, kind of believes in the Marxist theory of mystification, but he kind of arrives at the same conclusion I do. He's saying that people are kind of having sand thrown in their eyes by this vast PR operation and acting against their own interests. And to some extent, I believe that's true. And as far as entrenched interests, let me read you a short quote out of Elizabeth Warren's memoirs. She's describing a meeting here with Lawrence Summers, who was director of the National Economic Council in the Obama administration. Larry leaned back in his chair and offered me some advice. I had a choice. I could be an insider or I could be an outsider. Outsiders can say whatever they want, but people on the inside don't listen to them. Insiders, however, get lots of access and a chance to push their ideas. People, powerful people, listen to what they have to say. But insiders also understand one unbreakable rule: they don't criticize other insiders.
John Michaels, how do you react to that?
I think that's good political statement. It's good posturing. I'm not sure that Liz Warren was an outsider when she was influencing legislation well before she became a senator. I think that insiders criticize themselves criticize one another all the time. I think there's a huge difference of opinion, and this goes back to my earlier point about it's not a priesthood, it's a conclave, it's an interfaith conclave, where they're sniping between Silicon Valley and the Chamber of Commerce and or Wall Street and Main Street on all sorts of issues that are brought to the public fore through well-funded sets of interest groups that are nominally in the public's interest, but, you know, they have their own kind of institutional agendas. There's constant sniping among insiders to the extent that, the terminology to me is to say that Liz Warren can say she's an outsider. I'm a fan of Liz Warren, but I don't think of her. I don't think of her as an outsider. But, yeah, Lawrence Summers was the presidentially appointed Secretary of Treasury and then presidentially appointed head of the National Economic Council. These are figures that a presidentially elected official appoints to represent them. These are not kind of shadowy figures anymore. Once they're appointed by the president, they have the kind of president's political accountability. This is what we're seeing in this debate this week about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Let me interrupt you both just briefly, because I want to ask you about what's referred to as the hollowing out of the State Department. And apparently very few ambassadors have been appointed. Many have left the State Department either in anger or because they've been asked to go. And there are those who say that the State Department Mike Lofgren, I'll ask you this first, because it's certainly part of the deep state, as you have defined it, it seems to me. What's happening to it? Is Trump then disassembling it?
Yeah, this is, has many aspects to it. You cannot see it as some sort of concerted effort by either Trump or Tillerson or both of them as having some sort of a game plan in mind that's maybe we're just not smart enough to see. I think they're just floundering around, and as far as I'm concerned, I spent enough years in government to voice the opinion that Tillerson is just a very incompetent person. He would not see the acting assistant secretary for diplomatic security, who was urgently asking for a meeting to brief him on embassy security issues. Now, it was Republicans who made a big deal about embassy security over Benghazi, and they wrote a provision in law saying that the person who handled security had to have direct access to the Secretary of State.
That's the law.
But Tillerson didn't want to meet him. And this could not be some sort of brilliant plan to hollow out the State Department, because if some Benghazi-type incident occurred on his watch and on Trump's watch, it would be a political disaster. Why did they do it? Simple incompetence.
John Michaels, what do you say to that? Is this the deep state failing to do its job?
Well, the conspiratorial deep state, yes, because they're not being able to hold on. It also shows the fragility of the bureaucracy, which I think, again, kind of undercuts the argument that the deep state is controlling everything. It's an interesting moment, and if we're trying to kind of figure out exactly what's going on, you know, Rex Tillerson's a CEO, and, you know, long before Donald Trump came to kind of national recognition as a political force, officials from both parties wanted to run government more like a business. And so I think he's been constantly tinkering with his org chart and hiring consultants to figure out where we can streamline to make things more efficient. And, you know, first of all, you can't really do diplomacy that way. But I think that is in some ways motivating. Let's cut the waste. And kind of reinforcing all those moves are the other base of the Republican Party, the Trump administration's populism, which is a distrust or a disinterest in kind of being overly, the term that you often use is globalist, you know, or cosmopolitan. And I think those forces are kind of causing a bit of chaos in the State Department. During the hurricanes, Trump said, well, we don't need to fill all the FEMA positions because government's big enough. And, you know, we see this in the Department of Interior, where the chief climate scientist was essentially pushed out of his job. It's a, you know, it's a career job. Is that part of a grand plan? Is it part of, you know, a decision made in haste out of frustration? I'm not exactly sure. But there are don't count the kind of political forces out against the deep state. I feel as if they often still have the upper hand.
Mike Lofgren, first to you. What about the media? What's its role in all this?
The media, in so many ways, reinforces the status quo. I think that there's been a sort of refreshing discombobulation of the media now that Trump is president. I think they're doing a more thorough job, and they realize that stuff about the First Amendment and freedom of the press is really important. And when you have a guy threatening to take that away, who happens to be president of the United States, it really sharpens their game. What I saw as a staffer for national defense issues on the Hill was the military was a little, or not the military, the media were a little too eager to go along with the Iraq war. There were some honorable exceptions, like McClatchy newspapers, who gave a pretty accurate description that really Bush hadn't made the case to go to war. But most of them went along, and in the case of Judith Miller, they went along way too far. She was totally in the tank.
Reporter for the New York Times.
Reporter for the New York Times. I would submit she was so chummy with certain people in the Bush administration. It was a corrupt relationship. Corruption doesn't always have to involve money. It involves intellectual and moral corruption.
So, John Michaels, what do you think about the media?
So, I don't have much to say about the Iraq war for any number of reasons, but I would say that the campaign to delegitimize the media, whether consolidated media or disaggregated media, is deeply troubling. It's also consistent with a pattern of trying to delegitimize other institutions in American society today. Often those institutions seem to be the ones most critical and forcefully opposed to the current administration, whether it's scientists, whether it's judges who happen to be of Mexican descent. The campaign to delegitimize the media strikes me as incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And one thing we're seeing today is, I think there's talking about kind of public responsiveness, is we're seeing renewed support for media that we've been free riding for very long times, particularly in the internet age. And now there are more voices that are out there, and there are more opportunities, I think, or I hope, to do the kind of hard-hitting investigative journalism that had been on the downside, perhaps because of coziness, perhaps because those are really expensive. It's much easier just to tap your favorite source for some information than to dig in really deeply. And the newsrooms maybe are appreciating it, and subscription rates, from what I'm hearing, are through the roof.
Okay.
So it reminds us to kind of continue to support these institutions.
All right. We started out talking about
the
deep state.
Can I jump right in there?
Yes, of course you can.
Yeah,
go ahead.
My criticism of the media in the Iraq war is not to delegitimize them, but to say they need to do a better job. And I think constructive criticism can help them do a better job. And I will submit they are doing a better job now because they see their backs up against the wall with people like Trump running the show.
Okay, well, as we started out talking about the deep state, which turned out to be a much more complicated subject than anyone might have thought of, and I think you came together in some places, stayed apart in others. It sounds as if you pretty much agree with regard to the role of the media, the importance of it, and how it is changing at the current time, perhaps improving, despite what is said in the effort to discredit it. I want to thank you both for being with us. It's been a very fascinating conversation. Once again, Mike Lofgren is formerly with the Congress and now author of The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of the Shadow Government. And John Michaels, once a clerk for one of the justices of the Supreme Court and a lawyer in private practice, but now at UCLA, an author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. It's great to talk with you both. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.